Welcome to minute 146 of season 8 of Movie Robin, the daily podcast where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Mark Hoffmeyer of Movies, Films, and Flicks and the Deep Blue Sea Pod. Welcome back to the show this season, Mark.
Hey, good to be back. Good to be back. And now, I've gotten really good at throwing helmets because of these minutes that you gave me. I just want you to know that.
That's good. I know that you always practice, and you really are a method podcaster. You
know. Yeah, I'm recording this from a stairwell.
There you go. Wait, are you crying?
I'm always crying.
Probably not the same way that we're going to get crying later this week, but I am
crying in this movie, by the way. And you've probably talked about several great crying scenes.
In this movie, yes, but yeah. I know you're probably going to give me like a top five crying scenes in movies or something like that. You know, I don't know, but yeah, well, we're going to steer clear of that. So, Mark, why don't you first tell everyone what's your background with this movie? Do you remember when you first saw it?
Yeah.
Is it among your favorites? Is it something that you're watching just because I'm forcing you to do so? You know, how many different options there?
Saw in the theaters. You know what's interesting? It's a movie that'll forever be in my memory because I think around in the 90s, sound was greatly improving, and it was always in process. Sound was always getting better, but theaters were getting better, speakers were getting better. I remember watching Twister and just driving home and be like, the sound was insane. And then after getting out of Saving Private Ryan, I just remember the sound of it. Like, that was one of the formative moments of my theater going, because just the way it worked. And also, I mean, this movie's kind of like a horror movie, and it really has stuck with me, especially, you've already talked about it, but the speech that Giovanni Ribisi makes about his mom coming home and wanting to see him, but he pretends to be asleep. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most cruel moments in cinema history because, you know, we all know what happens to him. And it's just a movie that has always lingered in my memory. I love watching it just to remember all the people who pop up. It's such a well-made. And also, you know, when I teach film, and I always tell my students about how Spielberg knocked this movie out in pretty quick amount of time. And he filmed the Omaha, or D-Day attack.
Utah Beach.
Like, he filmed that, like, they were almost under time, like, the way he decided to do it. They shot it quick. They shot it fast. They shot it smart. So I love teaching my students about that and the camera work and just the everything about it. You know, it's a great film. You know, I own a really weird, fancy special edition DVD of it somewhere around here. It's like in a little steel case. It looks like an ammo box. I love Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you want to hear more about what happened on the set, I mean, back on what episode was it? Episode 131. So we're talking probably around a month ago. So one of my guests was actually an actor in the movie.
Oh, nice.
Corey Johnson. I mean, it was so much fun listening to his stories. I mean, again, he had a very small part. He was the radio man who got his face caved in.
But he's been in everything, though, Corey Johnson. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yes, he has. He talked about United 93. He talked about Black Hawk Down. He talked about Band of Brothers. I mean, like, he talked about all these different things. But he also was talking about just the way that this film was done by Spielberg and just how efficient it was. It was great. You know, it was so much fun listening to his thoughts on, you know, someone who was actually there, not just, you know, I heard from. You know,
exactly.
It's not 6 degrees of Steven Spielberg. It's 1 degree, you know, that type of thing.
He's been in everything. You know, now I know his name. I've seen this guy in everything. Now I know his name's Corey Johnson.
Yeah. He was just in September 5, and he now has a movie that just came out not long ago where he stars, called, I think it's Midnight Caller. I haven't seen that one yet. September 5 was great.
Yeah, September 5 is really good.
Yeah. So it was really cool talking to him and getting his insights onto the way that was all done. I also just found out, talking to him, I mean, obviously everyone already listening to this has heard this, 3 weeks ago when they listened to the episode, but you know, I always thought it was special effects, what they used for his face that was caved in. And he said it was a dummy. And he said that, like, he was there, and like he moved, you know, he had to move three times, or Hanks turns to him three different times. So after the second time, he said there's these two huge guys that were next to him that just like pulled him out and put the dummy in its place, you know, like really quickly done and stuff like that. So it's very cool.
That's why Spielberg's the best.
The fact that he was still using, practical effects. You know, you don't need special effects for everything, I guess. So that was just really cool. Yeah.
Dude gets his face blown off. That was crazy.
Seriously. So, minute 146 begins with the SS soldier looking at Mellish and ends with Upham slumping down. So, we ended things on Friday with Mellish having a very, very bad day. You know,
but I've been researching that. That's crazy. I know it's not our chapter, but that has never left me, that moment. Watching it again hurt.
My guest last week actually told me that this was filmed with Adam Goldberg up against a wall as opposed to the floor, and they just like tilted the whole thing.
And they figured it out like kind of close to the day. They're like, hey, we're going to have him get shot. And then he was good with bayonets. So then they're like, hey, let's have this battle and let's break everyone's heart and piss everyone off and leave them scarred.
That's right. Well, they wanted to show the brutality of war. And, you know, especially after it's a character that you've gotten to know quite well over the last 2 hours. And you know, any of these guys, when they didn't make it, you know, was sad. You know, even when you know, Caparzo would get shot because he's acting stupid. You know, that type of thing. You know,
it's all about family, though.
That's right. It really is. It really is, because you know, it reminded him of his niece. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So, you know, it's not Paul Walker, but maybe it was a reincarnation of Paul Walker, or maybe Paul Walker was a reincarnation of a little girl.
You watch these movies and you realize why Vin was so big in the late 90s, early 2000s. Dude had a great look, like great personality. Like now he's kind of, you know, not that, but you could, he used to be like electric on screen watching this again. He had a great presence. So but that's not our chapter either. But
that's fine. But I mean, Vin Diesel wasn't popular before this movie. This was his. Was the movie that made him a name.
He made a name for himself too. I mean, he popped on screen. And so did everyone did. This movie's ridiculous. This is, I hate using like slang, but everyone's cooking in this movie. They really are. I think, man, and Spielberg too. Just the way, I wish if there's only a handful of movies I wish I would have worked on, because working on in the entire shoot of a film is terrible. But I would have enjoyed working on this one just to see it and be there and watch the efficiency and get yelled at by Spielberg. So I would have loved that, to have worked on this film. That would have been cool.
Well, interesting.
Not much dialogue in this scene. We've covered When Harry Met Sally, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. A lot of talking.
We have a lot of dialogue and just repeating of the same word.
Exactly. SOB.
That's right. Right. So again, we start off with this little 2 seconds of the finale with Mellish, where you just see how proud this German soldier is for what he just accomplished.
Yep.
You know, I think that if it would have been the other way around, I don't think Mellish would have been proud of what he did. He would have just, you know, been okay. I'm glad I got out of that, and that was it. You know, as opposed to you know, in some ways it looks on the face of this German SS soldier, you know, that he's relishing in the fact that he is now, you know, killed one of the enemy that way.
You know, I mean, he's alive. Quarters. He's alive and he won a battle to the death. I mean, you're going to be scarred, but also I mean, if you've already battle hardened and you've murdered a lot of people and you just had your first hand to hand battle to the death and you won it, I guess there would be some satisfaction in a sick way, or like, I am alive. I won this battle. And they were pretty hard, those SS guys. I mean, I'm not.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I'm not really sure he would be. You know, it's as if he wouldn't have been affected by it. That's what I think.
Oh, as opposed to just being happy with the kill?
Exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, I was listening to research. You know, I was listening to like World War II experts talk about this movie, and just sometimes I have a 90-minute drive to work, and they said that hand-to-hand combat and like bayonet stabs and everything accounted for like 0.017% of all injuries on the battlefield. So he said fights like this were incredibly rare. So I mean, you know, I guess there's, I don't think he would. Yeah, he doesn't seem shook by it. And then he goes out and causes more damage. But I think, he lived. I don't know. Sometimes I think there's happiness in that. You just survived.
Correct.
And the other dude is dead. And that little guy on the staircase didn't shoot me.
That's right. Didn't even not shoot me. He froze up.
Yeah, you know. Completely froze up.
Right. And I also love the detail that we see sweat dripping from this guy's face.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the screaming. I know there's a lot more screams from it, but yeah, but also he's big. When that guy walks down the stairs past Upham and goes outside, that's a big dude. Like, that's I wonder if that was a stuntman. I mean, it's just a big, strong guy. And so, yeah, it's just, yeah. And then he lets Upham live. That's gotta be really insulting, movie Rob, when a guy during war looks at you and goes, this person is zero problem. This person.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Okay.
I have what to say about that fact.
We'll get there. Okay.
And then the shot changes and we see Mike, running among the debris. And he comes across a German soldier and he then points his gun at the German soldier and starts trying to shoot at him. And the gun jams. And the German soldier's gun also jams, which is pretty amazing that both of their guns jam. And then the German soldier just decides to take off his helmet and throw it at him. I mean, this is what you talked about at the beginning of this minute. You know, this is what you've been practicing. You know, have you gotten better at it? I mean, are you good at hitting the target at just 5 feet away?
Yeah, I would have hit if someone threw a helmet at me. I'm so good I could hit that helmet. My helmet would bounce off that helmet and hit another person in the face with it and kill them.
Oh, okay.
I've gotten that good. I'm kind of deadly with it now, so I got to be very careful when I throw my helmets now. I'm just that good now.
Yeah.
Okay. But the question is, helmets used as weapons. I was reading that in close combat. Like, they could strike people with it. Like, they were good for improvised tools. Well, even the psychological impact of wearing a helmet was good.
They used to have helmets that had, like, spikes on them and stuff like that, that you can use them also.
Oh, yeah. Who else had that? The German World War I, I know that they had some of those, correct? Mm-hmm. And then.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's insane. Someone hit you with a spiked helmet. Like, there's so many ways to kill you, and then that's, like, what happened to Hoffmeyer? He survived everything, but a spike helmet strike got him. It's like, jeez, the ways. They thought of everything to kill you.
Seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Tom Sizemore, he gets shot for the first time in this. He's been shot in a decent amount of films. Do you want to hear the other films he's been shot in?
Sure.
Blue Steel. He got shot in that. And let's see. Well, he gets killed by a missile in Flight of the Intruder. True Romance, he gets shot. Natural Born Killers, he gets shot.
In True Romance, the way he gets shot, oh my God. There's so much blood going all over the place there.
Yeah, that one's bad. Natural Born Killers, he's shot. Devil in a Blue Dress, he gets shot. In Heat, he gets shot. Enemy of the State, he gets shot. So up until this point, he's been shot. He gets shot in Dreamcatcher. He's been shot a lot. In SWAT Unit 887, he got shot.
Wait a second. What happened to him in what was that Bruce Willis movie? I can't remember the name right now.
The Bruce Willis movie.
Where he played his cousin.
Bruce Willis movie where he plays his cousin.
It takes place in Pittsburgh on the water.
Like Striking Distance?
Striking Distance.
I don't see – that's not in Cinemorgue here. So he might – did he survive Striking Distance?
I thought he got shot in that one.
Oh, really? Oh, maybe he's been – okay, so I'm only looking at Cinemorgue when he gets shot and dies. So maybe there's other films where he's gotten shot and lives, but he doesn't die, so he didn't make Cinemorgue.
Okay, that's possible. Now, the thing I love about the piece of trivia about Striking Distance that I always love is the fact that Tom Sizemore actually gave away the end of the movie during a like Leno interview.
Of
Yeah, people were not happy
course.
about that one.
Of course he did. Oh.
He got shot and not killed in Black Hawk Down. You know, but then in that movie, everyone got shot.
Yeah, everyone's taking flak in that one. Please, he might. There might be a record for him getting shot in films.
Well, you mean just like the way
Michael Ironside loses arms.
Oh yeah, okay. No, I
Like,
was
can they
thinking
stand
of
something like that?
what's his name? The damn, I can't remember his name right now. The guy who's died the most in movies. Lord of the Rings,
Oh,
played
Sean
Boromir.
Bean.
Sean Bean, right?
Let's
I think
see.
like Sean Bean has the most number of deaths in movies or something like that.
Well, like, all right, so let's think about it here. Fellowship of the Ring, he gets shot with arrows and killed, stabbed. In Patriot Games, he blows up. In GoldenEye, he gets smushed. So, I mean, I don't think he's been shot that much. He just gets
He's
smushed a
died. Okay,
lot.
no, he's died in 24 different movies.
Oh, wow.
Sean Bean.
In Equilibrium, I think he gets shot by, yeah, he gets shot. Oh, he gets in Airborne, he gets shot. In Essex Boys, he gets shot. He gets buried alive. Equilibrium shot. He gets hung. The Hitcher, he gets shot. Jeez Louise. In Black Death, he gets dismembered. That's impressive. Death Race 2 shot. Jeez Louise, Sean Bean. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, he's stabbed in the stomach. He gets his first three deaths appears where he has his throat slit, he was stabbed, and he falls to his death. And he drowns in a bog in a movie. I'll take that. Sorry, I
No,
digress.
not at all. That's what makes this so much fun talking to you, Mark. Anyway, I know that thing where things are going to go, so that's perfect. All right. So yeah. So the German throws his helmet at him, and then Horgrath throws his back at him. You know, like as if he just gave me an idea of what to do. And then both of them pull out their pistols. Now, what's great is that the only reason we know that Mike has a pistol is because he was playing with his pistol a few weeks ago. You know, when they were sitting on the stoop, he took out his
Oh,
pistol and was
yeah.
playing with it. Because most soldiers during World War II did not have pistols. The officers did, but just he's just a sergeant. But there were also what I heard. I've heard this. I don't know if it's true that a lot of soldiers brought their own sidearms with them.
That makes sense. Or pick them up as they go along, right?
No, yeah, but I'm talking about American-made weapons, not just the German stuff.
Oh,
They
wow.
picked up no, they picked up German weapons, as souvenirs. You have the
That's
whole,
true.
you have
Like
the
the
whole.
knife earlier in
That's right.
Saving, and then he gets a knife and he gets stabbed by a knife in
Right,
Saving
but it's
Private
not the
Ryan.
same knife.
Yeah,
I
I know. Not the same
yeah.
knife, but it's still like, hey, here's a knife. Awesome. And then
That's right.
foreshadowing. Yeah.
Possibly. Now, I mean, there's a whole thread in Band of Brothers, about that Hubler wanted to get a Luger. And then he finally gets one and gets and shoots himself, whatever. Right. But then one of the other guys said that the sheriff of his town sent him a package with a gun, to go shoot some Germans, that type of thing. So yeah,
I
so
hate
Mike,
that death in Band of Brothers. He shoots himself right in the leg, right? And then
that's
his
right.
femur gets hit.
That's right.
Or like the artery, not the femur, the femoral artery. Ugh.
Yeah, and unfortunately it really happened also. It's not like it wasn't just like make believe, like in this movie. And then they basically give us a quick draw between these two guys, which is something also you don't see much in World War II movies. This is something that you would see more in like a Western, and just to have Spielberg throw this little bit in here, where both Mike and this German guy are quick drawing to just try and shoot one another. It's just done really, really well. And also, they're really close to one another.
It's a brutal battle.
Yeah. And Mike takes him out right away and then gets shot by someone else. And I love the way that he's just, you know, he's like upset at himself that he managed to get shot. And he got shot in the waist. You know, he gets shot in his side. And he's just like, pressing against the side. Like, I can't believe that I did that. That I just got shot. And he starts screaming, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch. And he keeps going, son of a bitch.
Great then, limp, too.
Yeah, and then he shoots in their direction, and then when his gun is out of bullets, for some stupid reason, he throws his gun at them, which I wouldn't do that. You know, if I was in a situation where I was shooting my gun and I ran out of bullets, I would not throw the gun at somebody. I would hold out to the gun in order to put more bullets in it later. Yeah.
I think he just knows he's going to – that's it for him. I do. I think you just got me, and now we have to defend this bridge. I don't think he thinks he's going to make it by this point.
I don't know. No, I think Mike still has hope at this point. Later on, when he gets shot again later this week, that's when he might be losing it. But here he's not. I think he's still in it here. And then he falls against the wall of the building and starts checking himself for where he's been shot. Like, he pulls up his web gear and pulls up his shirt and is trying to figure out what maybe knowing him, he's trying to like take the bullet out. It's like, how do I get this bullet out of there?
Where is it? I'm taking it.
That's right. And then the shot changes, and we're back with Upham, who's just crouched on the stairs, just bawling away, just crying, because he knows that Mellish is dead, and he knows that he could have helped him, but he didn't. You know, which it's an obvious ploy by Spielberg to make us want to not like Upham for this very reason. You know, because of what he has done. He's just crying and crying and crying. Now, they give us a long time of him crying here. And then we see him look up and we see there's a shadow, and it's the German coming out. And the German comes out pretty calmly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and... I mean... And Upham just moves his hand away from his gun, saying, "Okay, just don't shoot me." You know, and the German guy just looks at him, and you know, you see that he's completely out of breath. The German guy, he just stares at him for a second, and then just leaves. He like walks down the stairs and walks right by him and just ignores him, but looks at him in a very strange way. Now, this made me think of Predator. Okay, from the perspective, okay, you mentioned this before about the fact that, you know, there's no sport in it. I'm not gonna shoot this little coward. More is more or less what this guy is saying to himself. He's like, why waste my time? This guy's not gonna shoot me. So you know, it's you know, the whole thing with Predator, how in the original movie the Predator didn't attack the woman. Because she was unarmed. She wasn't a threat to him. You know, so, you know, for him, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sporty to even go anywhere near her. You know, that type of thing. So I look at that from the same perspective here, that's the way this guy looks at Upham, that it's not worth wasting my time killing him.
Because that's, like you said, though, that's just murder then. I guess there's justification when you're in hand-to-hand battle and you shoot somebody. But if you just see a guy crying on staircases and you break his neck or stab him, like that's a whole different world right there, I think. Also, this guy's in France right now. And so he's been in combat for a while. Like, he made his way pretty far west. So he's seen a lot of it. Maybe he just knows that this little fella crying on the stairs is like you said, like a predator, no threat to him, even though he has a gun and he has weapons. It's a really interesting scene.
You might notice the fact that he has bullets that don't go with the gun that he has. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
he's got bullets for the 30 caliber, but you know, he's holding an M1. So I don't know. No, but here's the thing, the way you're talking makes it sound like you're sympathetic to this German guy, and you think that he's not gonna stoop so low as to murder. I don't know. I mean,
it's like squishing an ant, right? Like, Upham is nothing to him. And I'm not sympathetic. I just think it's more of like, this guy, this is nothing. I'm not even going to, you know, let's say he attacked up him because he doesn't have any bullets and then falls downstairs or gets, he's going to kill him. But like, let's say he accidentally gets shot. Maybe he's like, this guy will get killed later. I can walk out here without injury. And now I can go murder other people. I just think that's the way it is. Also, I think it's a mistake to, a lot of people have attacked Upham, but this is the most insane combat. This guy's never really seen combat. He's watched combat earlier in the film, but when you're in it, it's such a different world and he hasn't had the training. And, you know, as someone who bounced for many years, I've watched people just fight and they're like, people freeze when they have to fight. They don't know how to, and they get scared and it's just ugly. I mean, now it's talk about death and combat and bullets and like a bullet to your brain. It's the psychological elements are so intense that I'm kind of not a fan of people who are like, Upham's a wimp. He's a piece of crap. Like, I don't think we have a right to judge Upham.
No, I agree with you. I you know, I just look at the fact that here, you know, we know that because of Upham, everyone who died, actually not Jackson, but it's Upham. It's because of Upham that Miller died. It's because of Upham that Mellish died. That you can't blame those deaths on anyone else.
Also, let's think about this. Tom Sizemore grabs Upham and slows himself down.
Correct.
He could have been further up the bridge.
Okay, but again, that's separate. I don't look at it from that way, from the fact that Upham's presence, okay? I look at it from the fact that I'm looking at Upham's actions, okay? Upham is the one who convinced Miller that they can't kill Steamboat Willie, and that's what killed Miller, okay? Upham is the one who's standing here, you know, on the staircase and could have gone in to try to help Mellish, okay? He might not have succeeded. You know, I'm not saying that would have been 100%. But those two deaths are definitely on Upham. I mean, again, Upham is going to be, Upham is going to have to live with both of those deaths for the rest of his life. You know, there's no question about that. So it's not a question of whether he's a wimp or whether he's. I mean, the character. Yeah,
he's naive.
He's very naive. Correct. He's very naive.
But I also don't think Miller should have listened to him. This guy's never seen combat. You're behind enemy lines, and you have seasoned SS. You know, the guy's milking it for sure, but I just think Miller, he made the choice at that moment. His team didn't want that.
He made the choice. So he was convinced of it by Upham was the only one who was thinking something differently.
Yeah.
Everyone else wanted to kill Steamboat Willie. You know, Upham was the only one. I mean, I don't know if you remember seeing this, but you know, there's even a point where they show us. When they're digging the graves, and Jackson gives his canteen to Upham, and Upham takes a little bit, and then he gives it to Steamboat Willie, and then Jackson grabs the canteen from him, and doesn't want to let Steamboat Willie drink from that either.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I don't, but like, he's the naive one. Yeah. He's gonna have to live with it, but I don't know. I get, yeah, you're going to have to live with that cowardice for the rest of your life, but there's going to be a lot of woulda, coulda, shouldas, but these are such extreme situations that I don't know. He's going to live with it. He's going to ask himself, he's going to blame himself for sure, but I don't know. I think Miller and his crew are smarter than that.
He ends up killing Steamboat Willie. So
he does.
He's going to have to live with that too.
Yeah. He kills him in cold blood. But I mean, Steamboat had it coming.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Evil, you know, like, just, yeah, let's fight for the SS.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. So this guy just, like, bypasses Upham and goes down the stairs. And then, as you said, we see him, you know, at the edge. He's looking out, you know, trying to figure out where he's going to go. And then he looks back to see if Upham has changed his position. You know, is Upham now a threat or not? He's not. He looks around and then he runs out the building into back into the firefight. And then the camera goes back to Upham against the wall, who just slumps down again, crying.
And, you know, for a long time, I thought, you know, this is pre-internet 1998. There was internet, but I didn't have it. I always thought Steamboat Willie and that guy were kind of the same.
Or I thought that guy. I thought that too.
We just couldn't go online and look it up. And even if you had it on VHS, you're like, well, they kind of look alike. And then like, it just like that era, I kind of confused the two. And then I finally learned who it was. But
yeah. I mean, again, it's easy to confuse them. You have these two, two Germans with crew cuts that.
Exactly. Yeah, tall, beefy, not beefy, like strong-looking Germans.
That's right. right, and that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else you wanted to add?
This is great.
All right, excellent. So every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests will give their top five John Williams scores, themes, whichever you want to use on that. So, Mark, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right, number five, it's got to be Home Alone. So here's the thing. I'm 42. And so I didn't get to see Star Wars in the theater. I didn't get to see Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark in the theater. I didn't get to see Jaws in the theater. But I do distinctly remember just that gorgeous score for Home Alone. Like, I love the Home Alone score. So that's my number five.
Okay.
That's a really good one. Somewhere in My Memory. I like that a lot. Number four, I'm going to take The Phantom Menace, like Duel of the Fates. Come on. I was working in a theater when that came out, and geez Louise, whenever that song came on, I just wanted to pick somebody up and run around the theater with them. And it would have been very awkward, but it got me super pumped. I guess for number three, it's got to be Raiders. I know I said I didn't see it in the theaters, but that's just such an... I'm being boring here, but
You don't have to choose things that you saw in the theater,
No, I know. But, like, I know I'm being boring here by picking these scores, but I don't know. Raiders is just... you can't beat it. You can't beat it. Then I'll take Jaws. I mean, that's my favorite film ever, so I got to do Jaws. And then number one, Jurassic Park. I mean, being in a theater watching Jurassic Park... with a dun 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 dun, like, just, I can't, like, just, I remember just thinking I was in another world. I really do. I will never forget that experience of watching Jurassic Park in the theater in 93, and that score just booming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my number one.
I agree with you on that one. I mean, I actually saw Jurassic Park, I think it's one of the two movies that I saw 2 days in a row in the theater. One of three movies that I saw, subsequently one day after the other. And it was just amazing.
If you watch Jurassic Park on mute, it would still be impressive. But that score adds so much. And like during like the raptor attack, like there's some really great things that aren't the main theme. So yeah, I got to go to that. But I mean, Journey to the Island is great.
Yeah. Again, when you first see all the dinosaurs and stuff like that, it's just amazing. Yeah. All right, excellent. So Mark, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
They can find me at Stairwells Crying.
Okay.
Hiding in Ditches.
Wait in Rommel or elsewhere?
I prefer the Paris area. I prefer the Paris stairwells.
Okay.
It's still France, but, you know, I can go get some coffee afterwards, which is nice. So, yeah, I hang out in stairwells there. I might be creeping in ditches when you walk by. That's kind of where people can find me. Or they can listen to Movie Stones and Flicks or Deep Blue Sea, the podcast.
Okay. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieAroundMinute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to MovieAroundMinute@MovieRob.net. So, until tomorrow, earn this.
In my solitude, you